Every civilization has some food that makes outsiders wrinkle their noses, until at least we get used to it, and then it becomes the latest and hottest thing in any cuisine. Koreans have kimchi, the Norwegians have lutefisk, and Icelanders have a fermented shark. The French, well, they looked at milk and said, "Let's see how many different ways we can get this to spoil." Then they gave each one a different name and charged us accordingly. The remarkable thing isn't that these foods exist. The remarkable thing is that nobody threw them away. For most of human history, wasting food was not an option. If something smelled different, looked different, or tasted different, you didn't immediately toss it. You ask a much more important question: can I still eat this? Sometimes the answer was no. But sometimes the answer was one of the greatest culinary discoveries in human history. Today, on 4Q, we are going to make sense of the madness of cheese. I am your chief medical explanationist, Dr. Terry Simpson, and this is 4Q, Fork University, where we make sense of the madness, bust a few myths, and teach you a little bit about food and medicine. Over the past few weeks, we've been telling you the story of transformation. We started with fire. Fire transformed meat and vegetables, making them safer, more digestible, and far more delicious. And then we made soup together. Soup transformed leftovers into nourishment, stretched food through difficult times, and may have been one of humanity's earliest public health interventions, not to mention a far better source of electrolytes. Last week, we looked at bread. Grain became civilization. Bread fed cities, armies, and eventually my grandfather, who carried sourdough starter into Alaska during the gold rush. Today, we're going to transform milk. And in my opinion, this may be one of the most delicious transformations of them all. Now, nobody knows who invented cheese. It isn't like there is an ancient cookbook with the title, "How I Accidentally Invented Brie." There's no cave painting showing someone proudly holding up the world's first wheel of cheddar, but archaeologists have found evidence that people were making cheese more than 7,000 years ago, and perhaps even earlier. I don't even remember back that far. But somewhere along the way, milk became something entirely different. And they often wonder how that first discovery happened. Here's my favorite theory. Imagine a group of herders crossing the grassland thousands of years ago. Maybe they're in the Fertile Crescent. Maybe they're in the great steppes of Central Asia. Perhaps they're the ancestors of the horsemen who would one day ride across Asia. We don't know exactly who they were, but we do know this. They were carrying milk. Not in a glass bottle, not in a carton, not in a thermos. They were carrying it in a bag made from the stomach of a sheep or a goat, because that's what they had. And that milk kind of bounced along all day. And the sun warmed it. Now, inside the stomach, in your stomach, in my stomach, and that stomach lining they were carrying the milk in, is rennet, which is an enzyme that is designed to help young animals digest milk. Between the gentle motion, the warmth, the bacteria naturally present, that little bit of rennet all began changing the milk. And hours later, the people stop, and they open the bag expecting some fresh or sour milk, and instead, they find a liquid whey, curds. Now, if this happened today, we'd probably throw it away and call the health department, but 7,000 years ago, you did something else. You tasted it. That may have been one of the greatest decisions in culinary history. Was that exactly how cheese was invented? Probably not. Or perhaps it was. Nobody knows. That's the wonderful thing about the history of food. Sometimes we have the evidence, sometimes we have the clues, and sometimes we simply have a very good story built around decent science. But what we do know is that somebody noticed something extraordinary. Milk spoiled quickly, but cheese lasted, and that changed everything. Suddenly, the nutrition from milk became portable. Shepherds could cross mountains. Traders could cross deserts. Families could preserve food through winter. Armies could march carrying far more nutrition than fresh milk would ever allow. And the people of the steppes, the horsemen that would carry the horse milk, would arrive on the spice trail with something to go with some of the bread they had. And just as bread transformed grain, cheese is a transformation of milk. And once again, humanity discovered that the secret wasn't finding new food. It was learning how to transform the food they already have. Now, once humans discovered cheese, something remarkable happened. They didn't stop. They experimented. Every village, every valley, every mountain range, every monastery, every shepherd looked at milk and asked the same question. What else can we do with this? Now, somehow I'm starting to think of the Hallelujah Chorus when I say every mountain, but we'll let that go. But that's kind of the history of science in a sentence. Curiosity. The first cheese was probably some soft, fresh thing that was eaten in a day or two, but then someone left it a little longer. Someone hung it in a cool cave. Someone wrapped it in leaves. Someone salted it. Someone pressed it under a stone. Someone discovered that sheep's milk behaved differently than cow's milk or than goat's milk or any other milk, and they made something entirely different. Every little experiment became a different cheese. And what fascinates me is that no committee ever sat down and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, today we're going to invent brie." No. Thousands of little discoveries made by ordinary people trying to feed their families, slowly becoming culinary treasures. Take Roquefort. Legend says that a shepherd left his lunch of bread and sheep's milk cheese in a cave because, well, perhaps he found something more interesting to do. And when he returned weeks later, blue mold had covered his cheese. This poor shepherd was either really hungry or really curious because he tasted it. And today, Roquefort is still aged in those same limestone caves in southern France. We can make blue cheese in gleaming stainless steel factories using carefully selected cultures, but many of the finest Roqueforts still mature in caves that nature designed long before engineers understood humidity and temperature control. Sometimes Mother Nature built the near-perfect cheese cave before we built the perfect cheese factory. And then there is my beloved cheddar. It actually comes from an English village of cheddar where cheeses were matured in caves that provided cool, stable temperatures throughout the year. But let me answer a question I've been asked more than once. Why is some cheddar orange? It isn't supposed to be. Originally, milk from cows grazing on lush green pastures often produced a richer yellow cheese because the grass contained carotenoids, the pigments that will eventually become vitamin A in the cow. During the winter, however, when cows ate stored feed, the cheese became paler. So cheesemakers began adding annatto, a natural coloring from the seed of a tree, to make their cheese look like a rich summer cheese that people expected. Marketing, it turns out, began far before a television commercial. People expected their cheese to look a certain way. Now, Italy gave us Parmesan Reggiano, which is one of the great triumphs of patience. A wheel may age for years before it reaches your table, and during that time, the proteins slowly break apart into smaller pieces, creating crystals that crunch pleasantly between your teeth and concentrate the savory flavor we call umami. Here's a bit of fun irony. Social media loves to warn people about MSG, monosodium glutamate. And yet, those people who grate Parmesan over everything, well, Parmesan is naturally rich in free glutamate, the very molecule responsible for that deep, savory taste. Your tongue doesn't care whether the glutamate comes from Parmesan cheese, tomatoes, mushrooms, soy sauce, or a shaker labeled MSG. Nature discovered this flavor long before chemists gave it a name. Now, I'll admit to something. Since I've started my GLP-1 medication, I notice that I have to be a little careful with really well-aged Parmesan cheese. GLP-1 medications, as you know, slow stomach emptying, and for me, very aged cheeses occasionally produce what feels like a mild histamine reaction. That's not because Parmesan is unhealthy. Aged cheeses naturally contain more histamine because bacteria produce it during the aging process. Most people never notice. Since I've been on GLP-1s, I do. Medicine is full of reminders that average describe populations, not necessarily the person sitting in front of you. All right, let's travel north to Norway. Norway gave us one of the most unusual cheeses you will ever taste. It's brown in color. But if you've ever tried the Ski Queen Gjetost, put it on your list. It isn't brown because it's old. It isn't moldy. It's made by slowly cooking whey until the milk sugars caramelize, producing a sweet, nutty flavor that's unlike almost any other cheese in the world. Slice it thinly onto crisp bread, and you'll understand why generations of Norwegians love it. Yes, I'm disappointed Norway lost the soccer match. My friend Simon Majumdar will probably insist I now cheer for the United Kingdom, because if you're going to lose, you might as well lose to the eventual champion. All right, I agree. Fine, I'll allow it. But I'm keeping the Norwegian cheese. Every country, it turns out, tells a story through cheese. France gave us Roquefort and Brie. Italy gave us Parmesan. England gave us cheddar and Stilton. Greece gave us feta. Spain, Manchego, Switzerland, Gier, and Emmental. Norway gives us brown cheese, and every one of those cheeses began the same way. Someone transformed milk into something that lasted longer, traveled further, nourished better, and, quite by accident, became delicious. It's funny, isn't it? Cheese wasn't invented for wine tasting. It wasn't invented for charcuterie boards. Our ancestors were simply trying not to waste milk. And it took us about 7,000 years to realize they had invented the perfect appetizer. Now, for years, cheese has had a bit of an identity crisis. Nutrition experts would look and say, well, it's high in saturated fat. Cardiologists would look at it and say, with a skeptical eye. And the public would look at it and say, you're telling me Brie's trying to kill me? I'm talking about the cheese, not the lady. It turns out cheese didn't get the memo. One of the most interesting developments in nutrition science over the past 20 years is that cheese simply refuses to behave the way we expected. If you looked only at the amount of saturated fat, you might predict that people who eat more cheese would have more heart disease. Tell that to the French. It's not what the evidence shows. When research began studying people who actually eat cheese, they found something far more interesting. Cheese appears to be neutral for cardiovascular disease in many studies, modestly protective compared with what we'd predict from its saturated fat content alone. Now scientists talk about the dairy matrix or the cheese matrix or the calcium in there with the idea that foods are far more than the sum of their individual nutrients, but think about it. Cheese isn't just saturated fat. It's calcium, protein, phosphorus, fermentation, bacterial metabolites. It has a unique structure that changes how fat is absorbed and metabolized. And nature once again turned out to be more complicated than a nutrition label. That's an important lesson. We don't eat nutrients. We eat food. And food is chemistry wrapped in biology, and biology has a wonderful habit of refusing to fit neatly into our categories. Now, before anyone hears what I didn't say, I'm not recommending you eat an entire wheel of Brie while binge-watching television. Portion still matters, balance still matters, but that's why cheese has always had a comfortable home in the Mediterranean diet. It isn't the center of the meal. It adds flavor, protein, calcium, and satisfaction without becoming the entire plate. A little feta on salad, a shaving of Parmesan over pasta, a slice of manchego with fruit. Good food doesn't have to shout. It just has to taste good. Speaking of taste, let's talk about one of my favorite myths, monosodium glutamate. Now, as we said earlier, it has been the villain for years, even for those who have Parmesan. But your tongue doesn't know or care where it came from. My favorite lamb that I spoke of in Xi'an happened with a man over a barbecue with some lamb, salting it with monosodium glutamate. And you know what? It was delicious. If you've been listening to 4Q for a while, you probably know I was going to bring this back to the Mediterranean diet, because the Mediterranean has understood cheese for thousands of years. And here's the thing. It is a great way to bring food and family and friends around. Now, the more we've explored the series, the more I realize that every episode has been telling the same story. Fire transformed food, soup transformed leftovers, bread transformed grain, and cheese was transformed from milk. Again and again, humans didn't become healthier or more successful because we discovered some magic new superfood. We became remarkably good at transforming the foods we already have. We learned to cook. We learned to ferment. We learned to preserve. We learned to share. And that's civilization. And that is culinary medicine. And perhaps that's why I find food history so fascinating. Every loaf of bread, every bowl of soup, every piece of cheese tells a story. Not just about recipes, but about people who were curious enough to experiment, practical enough not to waste food, and generous enough to pass what they learned on to the next generation. So the next time someone hands you a good piece of cheese, don't just think about the calories. Think about the shepherd who first tasted curds instead of milk. Think about the monks who patiently aged wheels of cheese in those cool caves. And then think about the cheesemakers who spent generations perfecting their craft as some of the finest artisans you can imagine. And if that cheese happens to be sitting on a slice of whole grain bread with a drizzle of extra virgin olive oil, well, you're holding a few thousand years of human ingenuity in your hand. And that's not bad for a snack. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of 4Q. If you did, subscribe, leave a review, share it with someone who thinks cheese is still saturated fat wearing a funny hat. Now remember, while I am a board-certified physician, I am not your physician. Nothing in this podcast is personal medical advice. I would like you to talk with your own healthcare provider before making any changes in your diet or medications. That should be a board-certified physician and a registered dietitian, not a chiropractor, not a holistic fundamentalist, whatever they call themselves these days, which are just witch doctors. You can find references for today's episodes, recipes, and much more at drsimpson.com and forkyou.com, and the recipes at terrysimpson.com. This podcast is produced by Simpler Media, who does all things audio, especially my friend, the pod god, Mr. Evo Terra. Producer Girl Productions somehow manages to make me sound far more interesting than I really am in real life. If you meet me, you'd find that I'm a rather boring, quiet, staid individual who just quietly sits in a corner and, you know, you wouldn't even notice. Until next time, keep asking questions, keep cooking, keep transforming the food instead of fearing it. Have a good week, everybody. Now, Evo, if this closing isn't a little bit cheesy, I'm going to be disappointed.
Oh, yeah, I had so many things queued up, but can I go back to this bullshit?
If you meet me, you'd find that I'm a rather boring, quiet, staid individual who just quietly sits in a corner and, you know, you wouldn't even notice.
Dude, come on. Who are you kidding? Here's this, though.
When I'm slow on the draw and I need something to chaw, I hanker for a hunk of cheese. When my 10-gallon hat's a-feeling 5 gallons flat, I got something planned, which is little cheese sandwiches.
I hanker for a hunk of, a slab or slice or chunk of. I hanker for a hunk of cheese.